Mr. Errol Garner on Saturday morning. It's hot and cold. There we go. Can you? Okay, there we go. Just turn that down, Tom. It's Saturday morning, and Tom is confused. That's typical, though. Errol Garner, hot and cold. Good morning. Okay, got that out of the way. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. Oh, my. So it's going to be hot and humid today. And it is July. It is July 20th, the anniversary of the moon landing 50 years ago. I remember watching that. I'm older than 50 years old. I have to admit it. As a matter of fact, I think Monday was David Hasselhoff's birthday. And David Hasselhoff is my age, or I'm David Hasselhoff. I'm older than David Hasselhoff, let's put it that way, by a week, 2 weeks. So there. I think I'm better preserved. He's had more tribulations. Well, maybe not. I don't know. Anyway. Let's see. Oh, so the saga, let me get the text number, 601-207-4478. There we go. The saga of the pipe is over. The deed is done. We have completed that part of the project. We still are doing some grading, and there's been vast improvements. But let's see. We did it on Monday. We did an exploratory thinking naively that there was a place where we could tie into copper. That because copper's coming out of my house, right? It's going through the basement wall. It's copper tubing. So at some place, it would be logical there would be copper underground going headed out towards the water service. So we did a couple of digs around here and there and quickly realized that it wasn't happening. So we dug 180 feet more to my house, and Mark made pretty good stretch of that. 2.5 hours he was done. And we got to the house. First of all, we had to intersect with my wife's garden, which was a tribulation for her. It was a tribulation for me because it was a tribulation for her. And we fortunately, we just had to move a couple of hostas. We did lose a few plants in the process, and I've been made aware of that, which, you know, is kind of inevitable. It happens. But we moved two big hostas, and I was solicited to move these plants, and I had made a suggestion as to where to replant them so they'd be out of the way. And it was actually a good call, and my wife, being a much smarter person than I am, was able to determine where they should go. And after some hesitancy, that's a kind way for me to say on my part, I actually transplanted the plants for her, and it was pretty straightforward. When I just need to qualify this. When I was a kid, I used to mow lawns and do gardening and stuff, and I hate gardening. Gardening is not in my purview anymore. If I can avoid it, I will. But anyway, we did it, and it came out nice, so that's good. But when we got to the house, we dig down. We were down over 5 feet, and we come to the water line, and there's the water line. There's the copper pipe. And 3 feet out of the house, it transitions over to this godforsaken plastic. So somebody went cheap way back when. And so we dug it up. And we had already transitioned over to a high-strength 1-inch PEX tubing. And I'd gotten a call from Herb from the water district. Said, Tom, I think you ought to run 1-inch into the house. And I said, okay. And I said, well, we'll just use what we have here now, because that went to the house and had a little bit extra. And so all we had to do was flop the pipe over into the trench that was made, and then we could start backfilling. We got to the house. We had to go through the basement wall. Now, through the basement wall, my house is an old, old house, and it was an old rock mortar foundation. And from down in the pit where I once again found myself, And I put bug dope on this time. I was rooting around to try to get as close to the basement wall as possible. Now, it's all loose rocks. Okay, they're not mortared. They're just stacked. And all I could envision was getting hit in the head or worse. But I once again, it's all blue marine clay. So there I am slobbering clay again. But we got to a point, the pipe was disconnected, so we were able to monkey with it. I couldn't pull the pipe out, so we hooked it up to the excavator and pulled it out. But it's a 3/4-inch hole. We got a 1-inch pipe we want to put in. So I go back to my shop where I have a big Metabo hammer drill. And the biggest drill bit I had, I did have a big carbide bit that was maybe a foot 16 inches long for 3/4-inch. And I was going to put that in and just kind of root it around. I mean, you know, try to widen out the hole. Now, on the inside of the foundation on this rock mortar wall is a buttress wall that was poured in place that's 2 feet thick of solid concrete. So the basement wall is in excess of 2 feet, more like 3 feet, more like 4 feet thick. So I happened to stop in to see my friend Nat, former neighbor of our business, and I was telling him what I was up to, and he goes and gets this case, Hitachi case, with a huge Hitachi drill in it, with a huger Hitachi drill bit for 1 inch. He uses it for drilling into granite. He says, you ought to try this. And I'm looking at this thing, I'm thinking, this is going to snap my arms. It is, you know, this is a big piece of equipment. We could use a jackhammer. I had access to a jackhammer if we needed it. But so I went home with both drills and tried my drill and was like nothing. It didn't work, didn't do anything. So I went and got Nat's, and it was a very easy to operate thing. It didn't snap my arms like twigs. And it just pulled itself through the wall, widened out the hole, and it just made it to fit. So the next day, Tuesday morning, we cut the pipe, the temporary pipe, and hooked up the permanent pipe. And I replumbed in the basement. And we got a whole new water meter out of the deal, a whole new backflow preventer. And I got a bill very quickly from the water district that was very reasonable. And the budget came in pretty much where I thought the budget would be, which I would have preferred it less. But the overall, we did exactly what I thought, and we had done an extraordinary amount of work running 300 feet of water line. But that's kind of the way it goes some days. Some days you're the hammer, some days you're the nail, some days you're the person down in the blue marine clay. Speaking of blue marine clay, we got to take a break. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. It's 8:20. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. We got a text line 601-207-4478. So let's see. Oh, so, you know, the week started off pretty good. We got that plumbing stuff all out of the way. And we, in the process of putting everything back together, Mark was able to widen my driveway a little bit and regrade some stuff, and it looks pretty good. So we're just doing a little bit of spiffing up at this point, and that'll all be behind me. Thank you, God. So then middle of the week, my son moved. One of my sons moved, and I went to help him after work, which was a good time. The really good time, the reason he needed help was that he bought a house where the living space is on the second floor, and we got to lug all his big stuff up to the second floor. It was kind of a interesting deal, and it wasn't bad. It took a while because he doesn't live close by, but it took me a while to get there. The actual move wasn't bad. I brought my pickup truck and packed it like the Beverly Hillbillies, and off we went. And it worked out well. So I'm glad that's over with. got that out. That was on my docket. I knew it was coming, and I thought we were going to do it over the weekend, and we dodged a bullet there, not doing it today or tomorrow. I told him, you know, I'm working most days, but he had Thursday off, and I said, well, why don't we just do it tonight? Because it's, you know, it's not hot out. So that's all done. And I performed well for a guy who is not quite twice as old as his son. But it worked out. So let's see. What else we got? I have been fixated on a movie for a specific reason. The movie The Shooter. Have you ever seen this movie? They run it on cable endlessly. It's Mark Wahlberg in it, but it has Levon Helm from the band in it. And I didn't know it was Levon Helm from the band in the movie when I saw it. I just said, who is this guy? He is so good. He is so such a great actor. And I'm going to play the little bit of it here just so you can get this is one of the classic lines from, there's several in his, you know, he had about a 5-minute spot in the movie, but this is part of it. I just want to play it for you because I love the voice, and B, well, you hear. first time I saw that, you have to watch the movie. If you put in Levon Helm and The Shooter in YouTube, you can come up with a video of his clip. It is, I mean, what a natural actor, and what a great artist anyway. But this has turned in, the movie is, it's okay. You know, Mark Wahlberg shoot people, you know, it's a lot of blood and guts and stuff. But the Levon Helm part of the, I will watch the movie just to get to that point in it. Anybody I see, if I'm in front of a computer, I have to show them that clip just because it is, to see it is to believe it. Now, unfortunately, at the time, Levon Helm was, maybe he was 70. He passed away. He had cancer, and he had lost a lot of weight in this movie, and he just, you know, he was ill. But just a classic. So if you get a chance to see that, or you get a chance to look it up, by all means do, because you will be duly impressed, and you will rave about it to all your friends like I do. Or maybe you won't. Some other things in the news. Aerogels. If you're familiar with aerogels, aerogel is a very high-performance insulation material that is not used a lot because it's expensive, but it's a very high R value per inch material, and they think that they can use aerogels in Mars, in habitats in Mars, to make Mars habitable. In other words, the buildings can get solar heated and grow plants and have liquid water, because the testing they've done indicates that basically it warms the space up at least 100 degrees warmer. It's more than 100 degrees warmer than it would be otherwise if it was just a regular type structure. So everybody's excited about aerogels in the news. They're still kind of expensive for use here on good old planet Earth, but who knows? In due time, maybe that will change. They are available. You can buy them. I have yet to ever handle aerogels, but it's kind of it's a jelly-like material. Think of Jell-O, okay, where it's got liquid in it. If you take the liquid out of Jell-O, you have this matrix structure that if you took the liquid out, those spaces would be filled with air and becomes very light and very highly insulative, and that's what aerogel is. It's not Jell-O, but I'm using that as it's a gel, though, that they somehow removed the liquid from. Don't ask me how. Anyway, that's going to make life on Mars wonderful when we screw up this planet. Let's see. Thermoelectric devices, Peltier devices. You know those little fans you will put on top of your wood stove that turn with no batteries? They use the heat on the wood stove to operate. That's a Peltier device or a thermoelectric device. It makes electricity from heat difference. And on a wood stove, you've got the hot surface of the stove and the relatively cool air temperature. And these don't generate a lot of power, but they make enough to make that little fan rotate. Excuse me. They also use Peltier devices in wine coolers. You know, those refrigerators you put on your kitchen counter to keep your wine cool. Many of those are using Peltier devices as opposed to conventional refrigeration devices. And they're not very affordable. They're not very efficient, but they're quiet. And you can either make, you can heat or cool with them, or you can use temperature differentials to generate electricity. They're reversible devices. There's been some breakthroughs, and I'm going to mispronounce the... because I don't have it in front of me, the one of the metals that's used in Peltier devices, telluridium, I think. I'm going from memory now, and it was very expensive. I guess rare earth metal. They've been able to substitute or come up with a Peltier device that uses magnesium, with a material cost savings of about 9 times, which winds up with a device savings about 3 times. So the economics of thermoelectric devices that would take anything that's hot, that's in room temperature environment, and allow it to generate electricity. And this is a wide range of possibilities as the price comes down. And we're talking about basically an electronic device. And I think it seems to me most electronic devices kind of function loosely under Moore's law, which means that things improve. The computer chips, you know, will double in performance every 18 months and halve in price. That's true with computers. It isn't true with photovoltaics necessarily or Peltier devices, but they do follow a similar trend. That if there's a demand there, especially, the work is done to make these things work better. Computer devices, of course, have great demand. So there's economics involved there that aren't necessarily there as strong for photovoltaics and for thermoelectric devices, but it's there, and it is increasingly becoming more valuable. So that will make a difference in life as we know it. Speaking of making a difference, I'm going to pay some bills and keep the lights on right here at the radio station. It's hot and cold. It's Saturday morning. Stay with us. We come back. We'll take your phone calls at 1-800-966-1039. Text line 601-207-4478. Get up and dance. It's time. Hey, we're back to 836. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Good morning again. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. The text line 601-207-4478. I want to tell you about my friend Alan at General Appliance and Breweries, open 9 to 4 Monday through Friday on Center Street. And he is... he took off 2 days last week. He took off yesterday. Alan took off yesterday and Thursday, but he's going to be back all next week. And he's full weeks. I've checked. He's going to do the full week thing. Okay. He deserved a couple days off. I mean, okay. And he picked great days. So if nothing else, we can appreciate the fact Alan knows when to pick good days to take off. And I think that correlates over to his understanding of home appliances, don't you? And if you have a home appliance that's acting up, you want to give him a call at 989-4341 because he can help you make that appliance work again, if in fact it is workable, if in fact it is affordably workable. And if it's not, he will guide you in terms of what you should do next. And it's, what a guy, huh? Anyway, Alan, General Appliance and Brewer, my friend who has helped me out of more tight spots home appliances than I want to think about. But it's always good to have that help when you need it. Completely just zoned out there. I can't write the notes down fast enough as they come rolling through this. They kind of go in one ear and out the other pretty quickly. But it's been another busy week. We've got a whole bunch of heat exchangers we're making for a big customer out in the Midwest. Is doing a huge... a wood boiler project. So that material came in. I should work on it today, but it's going to be too hot. I'm not making heat exchangers today. I'm sorry. And in fact, I've got to do some batteries for some folks, get those turned around. So it's still going to be a fun day. Phone number again, 1-800-966-1039. A text 601-207-4478. Both are sparse right now. Excuse me. I know my wife is not listening because I just spoke to her and she's cleaning the house, so I can tell the story while she's not listening. In the process, you know, you're in and out of the house with all this plumbing and mud and stuff. And the house is all cleaned up. It wasn't that bad, but it gets a little messy. You're going up and down the basement stairs. Unfortunately, the basement, and she doesn't know this, is all dried mud. I've got to get down there and clean it up before she goes down the basement, and she'll be very excited. So I haven't gotten to it during the week, but I will do it. I'll do it over the weekend, and I'll tell you why I'll do it over the weekend, because I have got in my basement heat pump water heater, and that basement is blissfully cold because it's chilling. It's extracting heat to make hot water with the heat pump. So the basement is dry and it is cold. And in this kind of weather, it just is like, oh God, this is lovely. Speaking of which, while I was down the basement with the water district guys putting in the new meter and stuff, they look over to their right and see my pellet boiler and they go, what's that? It doesn't look anything like anything anybody has seen before, although to me it's, you know, it's just the pellet boiler. They were duly politely impressed. I'm not sure if they were really impressed, but let's do this. Let's go to the phones. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine. Turn down your radio, please.
Hello?
Yeah, turn down your radio, please.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I have a question for...
Sure, go ahead.
The question is, I got a house up here on Moosehead Lake, and I want to put more insulation on. I'm taking the outside of the house apart.
Oh, good.
And I want to add more insulation to the surface of the house, on the outside surface.
Yeah.
Is it okay? I want to put foam on the outside, like about an inch and a half of foam, or, you know, the Tafa stuff.
Yep.
Is that something that you can do, or will that not allow the wall to breathe?
It is something you can do, it's the ideal place to put it, because with an inch and a half of that material, you will keep the wall cavity warm enough that you would not have condensation buildup, which is what when we talk about breathing, we're trying to keep the cavity dry, or we're trying to not necessarily dry, but we're trying to keep it from having condensation form. So, you know, inside air holds some moisture because it's warm. When it hits a cold surface, that moisture can condense out, and this is where we get into this mischief with moisture. By putting an inch and a half on that outside wall, you'll keep that wall warm enough to keep the inside from having condensation. So
2 inches would even be better.
2 inches is even better, especially if you're living on Moosehead Lake. Now the ideal, now one of the tricks here is that if you bump out the wall 2 inches plus finish, you know, if you're strapping it or sheathing it and siding, you're even out a little bit further. Your windows and doors are kind of recessed. So the ideal would be to move the windows and doors out into that same plane. So they're now bearing on that outside surface. And this freaks out a lot of people, and there's a couple ways.
I am replacing those anyways.
Okay, so what I would suggest doing then, what are you going to put up for siding?
Well, right now it has a red cedar clapboard. That's
okay.
What I want to use.
Okay, so the ideal way, I think, and we can discuss it if you don't agree, would be to strap vertically, over the insulation. And then you've got an airspace behind your siding. So if moisture got in behind the siding, it's not going to cup. It's going to tend to dry, and it'll maintain it better, if that makes sense.
So, how would the wall go exactly? It would go, what, the siding and then a half-inch plywood?
Working from the outside in, you don't need the plywood. Your building's already sheathed. Now the structural part of it is done already. So you, let's say you've got red cedar on there now. You're taking off the old red cedar. Now you're looking at, let's say, plywood that's on the building. Working your way out, you would put the foam up, and really you don't have to fasten it very thoroughly if you're covering it. I would cover it with strapping, 3/4-inch strapping every 16 inches or so vertically. I would seal at the bottom as well.
So you put the foam first, then the strapping.
Yeah, and the strapping, you would screw through the strapping into the old sheathing, and that's going to hold the foam in place, and it also gives you a place to nail your siding to, and you've got an airspace behind the siding, which is what everybody likes to see in terms of especially wood siding. Additionally, where your windows and doors are going, you can put strapping around the windows and doors, and you have something to anchor to if you have a nailing flange. If you didn't have a nailing flange, if you want something a little beefier, you can cut, recess the foam back and make a 2x2 to have something more solid to anchor to for the windows and doors. I've done it both ways. The strapping is works reasonably well.
Okay, so it would go foam, strapping.
Yep.
Plywood.
No, siding. And then siding right over the strapping.
Siding would go right. And so would it be strong?
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, you can Google this concept of airspace behind wood siding. Just look at it. You know, take a look. There'd be some building science stuff you'll see. That's kind of the ideal. If you put if you put it right up against plywood or OSB, you tend to have a little bit more of an issue with longevity with wood siding as opposed to having an airspace behind it. They do make spacer materials that will hold the siding off of if you did want to plywood it. It'll hold it off the plywood about 3/8 of an inch, which again is ideal for wood siding. So that, and you know, if you're not putting plywood on top, that almost pays for your insulation.
Right.
Not have, and usually when we're sheathing a building, we're doing it for two reasons. We're doing it to obviously keep weather out of the building. It's more structural, but the structural component of it is the really critical part. It keeps the walls from racking and makes them very strong. Mm-hmm. That's already there. So by putting another layer of plywood on, all you're doing is adding a nailing surface that is kind of expensive, that isn't really necessary, and is kind of counter to really helping keep your wood siding have a long life. It's going to contribute to it aging a little bit more rapidly.
So how far apart would you put the strapping?
I think I would go every 16 inches.
Inches you can go?
I don't think you, I mean, you could do a foot, but I think 16 inches is ideal. And I think that's, and again, I haven't done it recently. I'd get online just to see with that kind of siding, what folks recommend if they do it every foot or 16 inches. It'd be one of those two. No more than that. But I think 16 inches is probably ideal.
Great. So it's a good idea to have an airspace between the foam and the siding.
Yes.
Okay, that's
and even if it wasn't foam, even in your original house, the consensus is now an airspace. It shouldn't be right up against a flat surface. There should be an airspace behind wood siding. It just helps it maintain better.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. You're doing all the good stuff. Thanks. I appreciate it when people call me and tell me they're wrapping a building in insulation like that, because it really is going to make a big difference in the performance of the building. The airspace is pretty critical. That's a consensus from all building scientists. Now, it gets a little trickier if you're doing shingles, because shingles you've got to strap horizontally, and you've got to have a lot of strapping, because your shingles exposure is what, 6 inches. So ideally, you're going every 6 inches or so. It gets a little tricky. So it may make sense there to sheathe it and use a spacer and I don't remember the names, but there are there's a couple of different brands out there, something like Raincoat or something like that, that is are used to it's a sort of a sinewy is not the right word, but plastic that's maybe a quarter inch to 3/8 inch thick and will support if you put a shingle over it or a clapboard over it when you nail. And but it creates an airspace behind the material, the siding. I think it makes more sense if you're doing, I think especially if you're doing clapboards, it makes sense to strap it, especially if you're just going over foam. And especially in a retrofit where there's already sheathing in place, you don't need to resheathe again. You can if you want to, but it gets, you know, it's expensive, and there's no need for it. There's no structural need for it, and it's kind of counter to making the siding last longer. So let's see. Phone number's 1-800-966-1039. We got the text line. No text this morning. Unbelievable. 1-800. 601-207-4478. Oh my. Oh, I'm sure Pete's going to call and we'll talk about it. Maybe he'll call. Who knows? Who knows what he's doing over there? But we dropped the price on our ambulance. My friend Chuck came over and we sat in the ambulance for a while and talked about the possibilities last week. Speaking of which, if you were in the cannabis industry, as it were, what better vehicle for delivering your herbal products than an ambulance? Speaking of which, this is just going to kill all my cannabis industry sales, but somebody did some, you're going to find this one hard to believe. I read it and I thought, oh, this can't be true. Researchers have discovered that people who use cannabis regularly suffer from memory deficit and slowed mental processing. No. Can that be? Oh, goodness. I don't know. Let's go back to the phones. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Yes, Tom.
Hey.
In reference to that gentleman that just called about his camp up at Moosehead?
Yeah.
Something you usually mention that you didn't this time was sealing the bottom of the, underneath the insulation.
Yes.
The critters out.
Yes.
You might want to mention that.
You just did.
All right.
I neglected. I was busy. I was busy just trying to convince him about the strapping. I could tell he was struggling with it. But you're right. Yeah. And we'll be doing our office in Stockton Springs. We've got the insulation, and I'm trying to BS Pete into doing it instead of me. What we're going to do is we're wrapping the building an inch and a half foam, and As a matter of fact, he and I had the discussion yesterday, a 2x2 of pressure treated around that bottom perimeter, and then the foam right on top of it will be adequate for what we're doing. And he said, well, why don't we just use the 2x4? And I said, well, then, you know, we have less insulation. We don't need the wood for anything other than that barrier for the insects. So
yep.
Thank you for mentioning it, though.
All right.
I get busy. I'm going too fast. Appreciate your call. See ya.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. I've got a text message here. Put up 2 inches of foam and strapped it over last year. Cut my heating in half and has made cooling and air infiltration a lot better. That's right. It does. And it makes the house a lot more comfortable because you don't appreciate the fact. I mean, if the building is constructed and it's wrapped in sheet goods, be they OSB or plywood, if everything is put together reasonably well, that's a reasonable wood barrier, or air barrier, it would seem. But the redundancy of an additional layer makes all the difference. And I did not mention it. Another thing I didn't mention is after you put up the OSB, after you put up the foam, I'm losing it here, aren't I? After you put the foam up, you want to caulk the joints in between the sheets of foam. I would also caulk it where it meets the eave, and I would caulk it down at the bottom where it's adjacent to the strapping, or not the strapping, but the bottom cover, And I would use pressure treated there just because it's a little bit less palatable to insects. And we're really trying to keep insects and other critters out of the foam. So it's kind of a cheap date and doesn't cost much to do. And contrary to what Pete says, ripping a 2x4, if you can't get a pressure-treated 2x2, ripping a pressure-treated 2x4 in half for going around the perimeter of the building is not a big effort. If you have a table saw, come on. But Pete's Pete, so we had that conversation. And I don't know if I've convinced him to do it or not. I have a feeling I'll, just because it's a construction project, we'll have both hands in it. Let's see. Got another message here. Tom Levenhelm also played Loretta Lynn's father in the movie Coal Miner's Daughter. I will have to look that up. I've not watched that whole movie, but I definitely will, if nothing else, I'll see if I can pull it up on YouTube. Better drop the price in the ambulance. Smoke is down. Smoke is down to $80 an ounce, just like the 70s. Doggone it. Oh, dear. Well, I'm selling it for a camper then. I have fixed costs here that I had to pay for the thing. So it'd make a great motorcycle hauler. You could get a couple of bikes in there and keep all the ambulance stuff for whatever other reason one would need an ambulance for. And there's places to there's a lot of places to sit, actually. Anyway. Do we have time? We don't have time for this last call, the hour. We got to take a break here. It's coming right up. So I guess we'll, I came across this. This is Elton John and Brian Wilson. And it just, any good Brian Wilson song is going to get my ear. And this is one of them. We'll be back in a bit. It's hot and cold. Stay with us. Hey, we're back. It's 9:06. We're having the big fun on the radio this morning, boys and girls. It's the hot and the cold, and my name is the Tom. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. The text line 601-207-4478. If there's ever a weekend to be listening to the Beach Boys, this has got to be it, huh? Don't never lie. Okay. Thank you, boys. That's the boys from the beach right there. Phone number again, 1-800-966-1039. Let's go right to the phones. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Oh, good morning. If I could add just a quick safety tip. Anybody rip sawing, first treated wood to wear goggles and mask. You don't want to be breathing and getting that stuff in your eyes.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Right. Good. Thank you. Good. Bye. Bye-bye. I'm not sure how many people do that, but it's not a bad thing to try to be safe. The good news is pressure treated is not quite as nasty as it used to be. It used to be extremely nasty stuff. Now it's only nasty. I'll give a further safety tip when it comes to pressure treated. If you're using it for a deck or a railing or something, to make it last longer, you really want to coat it with something or paint it. And I haven't tried it, and I'm partial to the these new coatings they have for decks that give a little fill in. Like pressure treated lumber, for the most part, is made from southern yellow pines. Southern yellow pines are very fast growing species, and they tend to check and crack a lot after they've been on a deck. So there are these. I guess I'd call it rather viscous coatings that are used to fill in those gaps and protect folks from splinters. Certainly if you pick up a splinter from a piece of pressure treated, you want to get it out of your body as quickly as possible. It is not, it's not good. There's any splinter, but especially that. So anyway. For what it's worth, 1-800-966-1039, 601-207-4478 is the text. No texts coming in this morning, just a few, nothing as of late. have been working on a number of projects during the week. It gets kind of challenging because I'll start working, say, on a car, that we're getting ready to sell. And the phone rings, or somebody has a battery problem, and we wind up rebuilding a battery. And we've had an extraordinary number of folks working on tank projects. So we've got a lot of that stuff happening as well. And as I said, we had a bunch of heat exchanger material come in the other day for a number of customers. And I should work on those today. But I do live near the water, and I should be down by the water instead of in the hot shop. But then again, nothing gets done if I go down by the water. Maybe tomorrow. Oh, no, tomorrow I got to mow the lawn. No. Oh, so in my ongoing quest to destroy every lawnmower I ever owned, I have persevered and hit a root on the while mowing last week and bent the mower deck so the blade busted through. And I have waited all week. I've been meaning, I thought I put the tools in the car. I don't think I did because I was just in the car this morning loading a whole bunch of stuff at Home Depot. And I noticed the tools I thought I had put in the car weren't there for me to fix the deck. Because, you know, now that it's going to be like 90,000 degrees today, be a perfect time to go out and lay around on the lawn and try to fix the lawnmower where I could have done it during the week. So I could mow because I haven't mowed in a week, and it's where we've had too much rain, so the lawn has not died yet. It just is inevitable. My wife told me yesterday morning there was a deer checking out our excavation work, and she wondered if that deer was a member of the Searsport Planning Board. Could be, don't know. And earlier in the week, we had two fairly newborn fawns and apparently their mother marching around on our property as well. So I'm not that I'm paranoid, but I am extremely aware of the fact that deer ticks are apt to be where my friends come to visit us. We scared away. We have a groundhog every year at our property that shows up in March or April, and the groundhog disappeared this week after all the groundwork. It just couldn't take it. My wife says it's time. Whenever we do something, like if somebody comes with a dog to our property or we have a piece of heavy equipment on the property, the groundhog hightails it out of there and goes to his alternate summer location, apparently. So phone number again, 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. I still have a major insulation project that we're working on, which will be the roof of our new building, which I have not done because we've been kind of busy with other stuff. But we've got to get some – we're putting OSB up on the trusses, and we will be filling it with cellulose. I got to get – well, it's July. We should probably end of August. We should be doing that when the weather starts to get just right for that kind of work. You know, not hot, because if it's not insulated up at the ceiling and you're up there doing stuff, it gets unbearably uncomfortable. And the other management decision I've made is that I think I mentioned this. We're going to re-roof our office building, which desperately is in need of a new roof with metal. And I decided to face the front of the building that faces you as you come in. We'll shingle because we have shingles on our other building. But the other three sides, I think we're going to wrap in steel. And for two reasons. One, it's fairly inexpensive. And two, it's fast. And it'll match the garage on the other three sides and make the building a little bit more secure because it's wrapped in steel. But it'll look reasonably presentable and kind of tie in with the metal roof. So that's I haven't even told Pete that yet. If he's listening right now, he just heard it for the first time. So let's do this. Let's take care of some business. Take a break here. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls at 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. It is hot and cold. It is Saturday morning. This is, of course, the Voice of Maine, Stay with us. We'll be back in just a bit.
Okay. We're back. It's 922. It's hot and cold on Saturday morning. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. Mr. John Hartford there. Oh, man, what a guy. Anyway, let's see. What else? It's quiet this morning. I would think I would be in. I would. Oh my goodness. We've got a whole bunch of text messages here since the break. Oh. My wife was given the record Peggy Day years ago. Well, yeah, that's from 1969. That was Bob Dylan, by the way, singing that song Peggy Day. And from the album called Nashville Skyline Rag, which we played a cut earlier, the Earl Scruggs version of Nashville Skyline Rag. Let's see. We got another text message here. Tom, I'm adding an open concept house. Currently, as radiant floor heat will be adding to our kitchen, and it will create a new large open space that is half the original house and half new house. Rather than extending or adding a zone to the floor, I was considering adding a heat pump for the additional heat load. Will this work? Or is it more of either or situation, both heat sources? No, I think it would work fine. Obviously, different kind of heat, but the heat is heat. And you have the luxury then of having some cooling from the heat pump that radiant floor is not going to afford you. So I think that's a good way to go. The issue here is one of figuring the heat load of the new structure and having the heat pump kind of match up with that, and but definitely doable and not a problem. Let's see. At the G, we got some pictures here of a what was called a monitor top refrigerator from 1938, made in Schenectady, New York, and the message says, at the GE refrigerator plant in Decatur, Alabama, I thought of Dick Hill's dad. It was nice of you to remember that. Just working for a living repairing metal coil, equipment manufactured here in Clinton, Maine. Well, thank you for sending that. Dick's father was one of the designers of the monitor top GE refrigerator. And it was kind of a unique thing. I believe they used sulfur dioxide as the refrigerant, which, of course, now is, I think, illegal. But it was very efficient. And I didn't know this, but the monitor top sat on top of a hole in the top of what was more or less an icebox. And really, many new refrigerators or current refrigerators aren't that much more sophisticated. In some ways, they are. Some ways, they're not. Yeah, Dick, and I always got a kick out of it when Dick would be, you know, he'd be in his 90s, he'd refer to, father did. What a guy. Let's see, we've got, how's the high mileage Prius doing, and does AC still work in it? I'm referring to my car. I just turned 413,000 miles. The AC does work. It blows me out of the car. I have to turn it. I had to turn it down this morning. It was still cool out on the way down, but the AC works fine. That being said, once in a while, somebody's car needs to be topped off, but no great exotic rocket science there. The Prius is a little different than other cars, some other cars at least, in that it has an electric air conditioner, in some ways I think that's simpler. You know, there's no clutch to go. You do replace the compressor when it fails, but I usually keep used compressors on hand for just that happenstance. A new one is kind of expensive. A used one will work fine. I've not seen it not seen them have many issues. So, but it's doing well. I reset the, you know, during the week, my mileage kind of stinks because of two reasons. One, I do short runs, back and forth, a couple miles here and there. And then I'm always having to, especially this time of year, jump on the Route 1 and hit the throttle hard to not die because I'm getting hit by somebody from Virginia, or there's some construction equipment in the way or something. So I'm to maintain and get into the stream of traffic, which just making a right turn on Route 1 this time of year is just a joy. So my mileage suffers because of that. I might be in the lower 40s like I was this morning. So I reset it when I left the house this morning and drove up here and
was doing 56 miles per gallon for the ride up from Searsport to Bangor. So I feel better about myself that it isn't me and it isn't the car. It's the traffic. And I usually am making the comment about entering a parade because there's a steady parade of traffic for much of the day, especially on weekdays. And I have a question, and maybe somebody knows this answer because it is vexing me. I'm watching, they're doing road work down where I live in my section of Route 1, and they've been digging out the drainage areas on either side of Route 1. And I assume there's probably, it's just filling in because of sand and stuff on the roads, but they scoop it out and then they seed it and grow grass in it again. And I'm kind of wondering how imperative that is, but I'll accept that there's a reasonable bit of stuff, you know, that stuff, that sand that gets on the road goes somewhere and it just goes basically in the ditches. But having done that, they're now putting curbs on different, I don't know if they're doing all of Route 1 or just parts of it, but am I missing something here? Did I miss a memo about curbs? They're asphalt curbs, okay? And it seems to me anytime I've seen an asphalt curb anywhere in the state of Maine, that asphalt curb at some point in its life gets removed by a snowplow. Am I being peculiar here? Just, I mean, hey, I do the radio show. I could be peculiar, right? But it seems kind of ridiculous to put curbs on a road like that. We'll see. Well, time will tell, prove the tale, whether I am right or wrong. But I'm curious if there's some reason I don't understand. Is it for channeling water a certain way? Or it doesn't seem like it. I mean, the areas where they're putting them, there were no curbs before. I don't think anybody has been flooded, but I'm just kind of, I'm trying to explain to myself. And I say to myself, Tom, why are they putting curbs there? And Tom has no good answer. So I don't know. But I'm curious. If you know, you can let me know, because I am very confused on Saturday mornings. But I'll make it easier on myself because I'm going to listen to Lewis. Okay, we're back. It's 9:34 here. It's hot and cold on Saturday morning. And a quick text message here from the person with the radiant floor who wants to blend in a heat pump, wants to know about tricks keeping the thermostats in sync. How do they work together? It might be a little playing there. I would be inclined to set them both the same temperature and just see if one shuts off prematurely. You may want to play with the radiant floor temperature, maybe dropping it a little bit lower. It depends how much of the load the heat pump can pick up. Ideally, I think the heat pump is going to give you the greater efficiency. The radiant floor is an effective way to keep warm. But if it may be that the heat pump is big enough to, maybe in theory, the heat pump's big enough to carry the whole load. If that was the case, I would be giving priority to the heat pump and have that at a slightly higher temperature, the radiant floor at a slightly lower temperature, maybe running the radiant floor itself at a lower water temperature so the floor still stays warm but isn't giving up quite as much heat and the heat pump is picking up much of the load. So it's going to be something you play with. So I hope that isn't too confusing. Over to line one we go. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Good morning, Tom.
Hey.
You're the expert on the great stuff, and I had a problem. I bought some recently, hadn't really used much of it in the past, and I had built a little greenhouse window for my wife, and beneath it, I tapered it. It stuck out about a foot and a half, and I tapered it back to the house below it with OSB. And the seams, I wanted to put some great stuff in there, and I bought some. And I guess maybe it was because I pulled the straw rather than push it. As I worked from top to bottom, as I put it on, it rolled right back off. It didn't stay on. It was like a snake rolling back to the can as I was pulling the straw down. and I was wondering why. It seemed like it wasn't sticking. And I'm thinking now maybe I should have pushed the straw rather than pull it. Do you know anything about that?
It has to be able to, there are a couple of tricks here. One is it has to be able to grab onto something, and if there's too much weight of the actual foam, it's going to tend to not stick. One trick would be to use tape and put maybe get a piece of 2 or 3 inch wide masking tape, half of it on one side of your joint, and put it on actually in the center of the tape, and then put the tape on the other side that you're trying to seal. And now yeah. you're pushing the foam. The tape is not upside down like the your joint is. So the foam would get pushed up into the joint, and in an hour or two it would cure, especially in this kind of weather. And I would leave it overnight, and then you should be able to peel it off and have a reasonable bond.
That's a lot of work. I think what I've decided to do instead, now that I had all this trouble, is just to use caulking compound to seal the.
You could do that too. I use if I'm doing something like that, I actually use clear packing tape because the foam will not bond to it, and it's easy to see what's going on in terms of whether it fills the joint or not, and I get a nice smooth seal. I don't have to trim the foam afterwards, so it's a little bit different operation.
Well. That I don't understand, but I thought this foam was going to be just stick to anything right away, but it doesn't.
Well,
other than my fingers, it's stuck to my fingers.
It's good if you want to grow a second layer of skin, and it sticks to clothing extraordinarily well.
Yeah, right.
So,
what a disappointment, though. It made a big mess.
Yep.
And now I'm trying to scrape it off.
Yep.
So I can put the caulking in the seam.
Yeah. Well, it is a little trickier. You picked a tricky application because you're basically upside down trying to fill that joint. And that's where the tape is really critical because as one who has done this, the tape is sort of the secret trick. But if that's too challenging, just caulk it. And the caulk will stick. I would just use a latex acrylic caulk, and you're done.
Okay, Tom.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
But just to explain again, I didn't think it was too confusing, but I might not have explained it real well. If I had a piece of wide tape, and I think masking tape would be okay. I use packaging tape because we have it in the shop. And it's usually what I get my hands on the first moment I need it. And I would cover, I would go down one, I'd center it. So half of the tape is on one of those surfaces that you're trying to seal the gap with. And then I would foam down the tape where it's right underneath the gap because the edge of the tape is right at the edge of the gap. And I just swing it around to the other side and tape it. And smoosh it, you could smooth the tape out. The foam is going to be expanding a little bit, but you can hold it in place. And once it cures, you're going to have a pretty smart looking bond there. It will be a smooth surface. Dust and dirt also, text here from Rob. Dust and dirt also prevents the foam from sticking in there as well. Yeah, but if it's a cut piece of wood, OSB, it's a little bit of rough of surface there, and it will usually bond better, but even on a vertical joint, sometimes it'll fall out. But an upside down joint like this, it's a lot harder to get it to stay in place. Take it from one who has done this many times. I'll never forget the Christmas I decided to seal some cracks in our den with canned foam with a brand new, I think it was an L.L. Bean shirt. And I carried that foam with that fine shirt for many years and just reminded myself, don't do this. And I still do it, but I try to think that I wouldn't do it anymore. Good morning. You're on The Voice of Maine.
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Hey, I'm good, Tom. How are you?
Well, I'm okay, but I have a question that well, it makes me wonder about air conditioning and automobiles. And I've done quite a bit over the years. I had a very good mentor, 35 years ago, that taught me quite a bit. And what I've discovered is, for some reason, the hotter it is and the more humid it is, the better automotive air conditioning will usually work if everything is operating correctly. And I'm saying this in view of the fact that doing a lot of automotive air conditioning, a lot of recharging, I've installed it and whatnot. You know, I have a very accurate snap-on dial-type thermometer that I stick into the vents. And so it's not my imagination. Like on a morning like this morning, I can get 38 degrees coming out of the vents. And on a so-so warm day, you know, maybe 75 to 80 or so, 85 degrees, yeah, maybe I can get a maximum of about 40 degrees. And this is all pertinent to what's, you know, reading out on the dial-type thermometer. So I wonder why it would work more efficiently, you know, at higher temperatures and more humidity than it would, you know, on a nominal warm day. Any ideas?
Yeah, you caught me off guard with this one. My first reaction is it may be that the cooling fan is running continuously in this kind of weather, as opposed to maybe intermittently on a less hot day. I mean, I noticed when I've got AC running on days like today, that blower, the outside blower, on it's just going nonstop. It just doesn't shut off. And on a Prius, it's very noticeable because it's usually quiet. You know, the cooling fan usually isn't running unless the car is running. But just in idle, it was different. I'm sure there's something going on with the wet bulb aspect of it as well, but I don't know what that is offhand. That's an interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if the higher humidity, because you know, like I remember years ago, I had a customer with a window air conditioner that they were complaining about all the water splashing around inside from the evaporator fan, you know, running, and the humidity and the condensation that occurred inside the base of the air conditioner splashing around, making noise, and they thought something was wrong. Well, the drain holes were okay and whatnot, but then I heard from, you know, again, someone that's very knowledgeable saying that that's purposed, because what they want is some of that water to splash onto the coils to aid in the cooling in the evaporator part of the system. And it kind of made sense to me. And so I'm wondering if just a higher humidity, like on a day like today, you know, does something. The air is denser or whatever, and it pulls away more heat away from the condenser to end up giving you cooler air inside the vehicle. So, but, you know, it just seems illogical that, you know, as things get hotter, just like your, say, like your home heating system, if it gets colder out, your system has to work harder. And then if it reaches the breaking point where it just can't keep up with it, because it's so cold out, or your insulation quality is so low, or your heating source isn't able to match what's required, then it's going to start to feel colder inside the house. So I wonder if the, you know, it's just a puzzling situation. I'm happy for it. I'm, you know, it's better than sitting in a car and sweltering as your air conditioning starts to fade out and, you know, go away. But yeah, interesting point. I wish Professor Hill.
Yeah, this is a Dick Hill question, if ever there was one. He'd go into a dissertation about wet bulb and humidity and relative humidity and grains of humidity. And hey, a quick question for you. Have you ever been in a Chevrolet Volt?
No, I haven't.
I got one a couple of weeks ago, and I've been working on it. And it's an experience, I want to tell you. When you hit the hit the power button, it makes a throttling up noise like you're in a spaceship. And I mean, it's all show, but it's an interesting car. I'm I've got to get it in the shop for an alignment and some other things, but it's I'm kind of getting into the car, with the exception, it's a four, you know, it's got a front seat, back seat. The back seat is not for people with legs, apparently.
Right, kind of like a Porsche 911.
Yeah, exactly. Very much so.
Those rear seats are only there for insurance reasons to make it turn into a so-called four-seater. That's what I was
talking about. Oh, okay. That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, this is the same where you put groceries back there, I guess.
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, didn't they stop production of the Volt?
They did. They did. And I think probably because they're directing more energies towards just pure electrics. It's a nice car. I'm kind of impressed with it. The complexity of a hybrid, if you go to pure electric, it becomes a much less complicated automobile. But the hybrid gives you that security of not worrying about, not having that range anxiety of running out of power at some point.
Yeah. And you just got to carry that really long extension cord.
Yeah. Or find a place to plug in. Thanks, Tom. See ya.
Yeah, stay cool. Bye-bye. Take care.
All right. See ya. Stay cool. That was, I got a text message here. Was that Papa Bear? Yes, that was Papa Bear, otherwise known as Tom from up in the Guilford area. Let's see. I know him as Tom, so I'm not sure where the Papa Bear thing comes in, but, what do I know? Let's go over to line two. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine. Hello? There's nobody there. We'll try line one. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Morning, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
To answer Papa Bear's question, I work at Nile.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Compressors do work harder when there's more moisture. So if the humidity is up, your AC is going to work harder.
Okay. And why is that?
Because what your EVAP is doing is it's cooling down to get rid of the pressure.
Okay.
And the moisture in the air condensing on that coil means that it's all going to have to work harder to pressurize.
Okay.
And it increases the efficiency of the whole system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there. Have we met?
You too.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. I was asking him if we have met. He didn't say who he was from Nile, but I've met quite a few of the folks who work there. And great company, by the way. And very chagrined that they're no longer making heat pump water heaters, as are many of the people who listen to this radio program. We've had this conversation before. Let's see. Line one. There we go. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Good morning, Tom.
Hey.
Great show as always.
Thanks.
Question. We've got a place we're redoing, a foot home. We ended up, it's got a 6-foot cinder block basement in it.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up putting a new floor in just to pretty it up, busted up the old one, put a new one in, vapor barrier, all of that. And then we thorough sealed the walls on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a period of the last 3 months. But once we did that, the walls started to condensate like you wouldn't believe. It's like, it is dripping water on the floor off the wall. It's something out of a horror film. And we thought it would just, maybe over time would equalize and it was a humidity problem. But again, this has been over the last 3 months. So it came through some cold temperatures. We didn't put any heat in the house as of yet.
Mm-hmm.
We're waiting to see what was happening, but it's just not stopping. It still continues today. We don't know what to do with it.
So you have liquid water coming, forming on the wall?
Yes, it's condensation. I say that it is. It's water droplets. It's not something coming through the wall. Like I said, it's been the basement's tight. It was thorough sealed. All was good. And then, the next day after we did it, it started to, make water.
Is it discrete areas or is the whole wall covered with droplets?
It's pretty much, I'm going to say most of the walls, if you will. It sits relatively close to the street, if you will, by that, let's say, there's 10 feet between the front foundation wall and the residential street that it's on.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's creating more to the back of the house, if you will, not that front wall.
Okay.
But I'm not saying it's not creating some in the front. And we didn't know at first that maybe there was a frost issue, et cetera. We didn't know. But now, 3 months later, still making water. We don't even dare, insulate it per se, unless we do a spray foam, because we don't want to trap the moisture either.
Well, I'm thinking maybe the moisture always was there. It's just forming, cinder blocks are kind of permeable. Mm-hmm. If you look at the wall, what's above grade versus what's below grade, is there a difference?
Yes, it's only below grade that it's quote unquote making water, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
We're perplexed.
Yeah. Were you thinking of spray foaming it?
Well, it wasn't quote unquote in the budget, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it's something we have to do to stop the water. I mean, we thought at first about running a space heater down there and kind of superheating the basement to see if that would do anything.
Yeah.
You know, to equalize, if you will, on both sides, just to see if we could make it stop, to see if it's a temperature difference that's causing it. Because the basement, like most, I mean, it stays very cool versus the outside ambient temperature.
Yeah. I'm thinking out loud now. My first thought is that you've kind of, when you put something like that on the wall, you tend to seal it. And where the cinder block is very permeable and maybe moisture is transmitting through, and escapes as water vapor because it's a big surface and it's all permeable. When you go to seal it now, you're trapping that moisture and kind of concentrating it to certain areas. And I think that's what you're seeing here. And I'm kind of at a loss as to whether my first thought is to try a waterproof paint and see if that helps. And that might be reasonably cheap to try, at least on a test area, to see if it mitigates the problem. If not, you know, spray foam certainly would take care of it if it's a permeation issue, which it sounds to me like it is, and certainly it's temperature driven as well. That's kind of where I would lean towards right now, is just to get a quart maybe of, or even a gallon of some sealant paint and see if that helps to stop the problem, because it's still a concrete based material and it's still kind of permeable.
The ferro seal, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess I'd give that a go. Is the floor wet? The basement floor wet?
Well, just from the wall runoff, but no, there's nothing coming up, quote unquote, through the floor, so to speak.
Okay, so it wasn't
the reason why we did that. There was some water. I wouldn't say water problems, but there was some. It was soft under that floor, and we put in drainage pipes, crushed stone, all of that happy jazz to get let the water find a home and get through.
Oh,
so I'm thinking maybe this groundwater behind that wall, perhaps.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about this. It may be just that your concrete slab is drying out, hitting that cold surface and condensing there.
You know what? Never thought of that.
Yeah. That makes a lot more sense than anything else I just said.
That's right. That's right, because that is still curing, and we have sealed that basement.
Yep.
You know what I mean? That basement is airtight, so you're right. As that concrete is curing, where's that water going to go?
Yeah.
Got to go somewhere.
So ventilate it.
Yep. Ding, ding, ding. Circle gets square.
All right.
Thanks, boss.
Okay.
Appreciate
it. See ya. Yep. Bye-bye. Yeah. Okay. Problem solved. It took a minute, but we got there. We got a couple minutes left. We got some text here. Can you install one or two solar electric panels and hook them to your existing system to reduce draw from power company, or is that a grid-tied system? That is a grid-tied system. And you have to get permission from the utility to do that. I suspect at some point there may be the possibility of doing a small plug-in system where you have a solar panel and it plugs into an outlet, syncs with the utility. It doesn't overwhelm the system, does not back feed into the grid. You don't store any power with the utility. You just are converting that power. Let's say you got an air conditioner running and it syncs up to run the air conditioner. That would be one thing. The other would be to get permission from the utility. Let's see, we're going to run out of time here in a second. So, and I did not queue up. Let's do it the right way. We're going to run out. I'm stammering here because I'm trying to get my music queued up before the end of the show, and the end of the show is upon us. So we'll see you all next week.